feel rather inadequate after having to follow up on that. So, but thank you, Lenore. That was a wonderful prayer and very much actually captures the passage that we're going to be reading today. Any of you remember flannel graph? Yes, we have some Sunday school kids here. This was before VeggieTales. This is analog VeggieTales, people. Flannel graph was felt, little animated felt people put on a felt board, and so they stuck on what was called the flannel graph, and it was like little scenes that they would present, little Bible scenes. And so this is how Sunday school teachers would tell their students, the people in the room, little Sunday school stories, little stories from the Bible. And today we're reading one of the most famous stories in all of Scripture. If anyone knows anything, if they've heard about the Bible at all, this is probably one of the stories that they could name. And flannel graph makes it seem kind of cute. And in a sense, it is, it's a story that can be pitched relatively easily to a very young audience, and it should be. And it's not that anything that was pitched there wasn't true. There are lots of good things about it, and I value the tradition that I came from that actually valued teaching small children basic truths from Scripture. But when it comes to turning that story into a sermon, I came to this passage with a fair amount of, ugh, you got to be kidding me. This is, I got to do a cute story. But as I started getting into it, you know, as regularly I find happens with me, I don't know if it ever comes out here, but for me, I get to these stories that seem so familiar. I'm like, when I spend time with it, it's like, oh, there's more here than I thought. And there's more here than I think I at first thought, and maybe you will as well. So please turn with me to Daniel in the Lion's Den, Daniel chapter 6. Beginning at verse 1. Now it pleased Darius, who's the king, Darius, to appoint 120 satraps. These are advisors, rulers now. 120 satraps to rule throughout the kingdom, with three administrators over them, one of whom was Daniel. The satraps were made accountable to them so that the king might not suffer loss. Now Daniel so distinguished himself among the administrators that among the administrators and the satraps by his exceptional qualities that the king planned to set him over the whole kingdom. At this, the administrators and satraps tried to find grounds for charges against Daniel in his conduct of government affairs, but they were unable to do so. They could find no corruption in him because he was trustworthy and neither corrupt nor negligent. Finally, these men said, "We'll never find any basis for charges against Daniel unless it has something to do with the law of his God, his religion." So these administrators and satraps went as a group to the king and they said, "May King Darius live forever. The royal administrators, the prefects and satraps and advisors and governors, we've all agreed that the king should issue an edict and enforce the decree that anyone who prays to any god or human being during the next 30 days, except for you, your majesty, that they should be thrown into the lion's den. Now, your majesty, issue the decree and put it in writing so that it cannot be altered in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be changed, repealed." So the king Darius put the decree in writing. Now, when Daniel learned that the decree had been published, he went home to his upstairs room where the windows opened towards Jerusalem. Three times a day, he got down on his knees and praying, giving thanks to his God, just as he had done before. Then these men went as a group and found Daniel praying and asking his God for help. So they went to the king and spoke to the king about his royal decree. "Did you not publish a decree that during the next 30 days, anyone who prays to any god or human being except you, O king, would be thrown into the lion's den?" The king answered, "The decree stands in accordance with the law of the Medes and the Persians, which cannot be repealed." Then they said to the king, "Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, your majesty, or to the decree that you put in writing. He still prays three times a day." When the king heard this, he was greatly distressed. He was determined to rescue Daniel and made every effort until sundown to save him. Then the men went as a group to King Darius and said to him, "Remember, your majesty, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict of the king issues can be changed." So the king gave the order, and they brought Daniel, and they threw him into the lion's den. The king said to Daniel, "May your God, whom you serve continually, rescue you." A stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and the rings of his nobles so that Daniel's situation may not be changed. Then the king returned to his palace and spent the night without eating or without any entertainment being brought to him, but he couldn't sleep. At the first light of dawn, the king got up and hurried to the lion's den, and he came near the den. He called out to Daniel in an anguished voice, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to rescue you from the lions?" And Daniel answered, "May the king live forever. My God sent his angel, and he shut the mouths of the lions. They have not hurt me, because I was found innocent in your sight, nor have I ever done any wrong before you, your majesty." The king was overjoyed, and he gave orders to lift Daniel out of the den. And when Daniel was lifted out of the den, no wound was found on him, because he trusted in his God. At the king's command, the men who had falsely accused Daniel were brought in and thrown into the lion's den, along with their wives and children. Before they reached the floor of the den, the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then King Darius wrote to all the nations and peoples of every language in the earth, saying, "May you prosper greatly. I issue a decree that in every part of my kingdom, people must fear and reverence the God of Daniel, for he is the living God, and he endures forever. His kingdom will never be destroyed. His dominion will never end. He rescues and saves. He performs signs and wonders in the heavens and on earth. He has rescued Daniel from the power of the lions." So Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus the Persian. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Before we get into the story, I need to be honest with you because you need to be aware of this, because this information is just widely available. There is actually no historical record of a person named Darius the Mede, the king, describing this story, outside of this particular story. There is a Darius mentioned elsewhere in Ezra. That's a different Darius from later on, different time period. Historically speaking, outside of this particular passage, Darius the Mede does not exist in any extent existing literature, inscriptions, etc. So, what do biblical interpreters do with this? They basically do two or three things. They either say that, a couple of decades ago, the same was true about Belshazzar in chapter 5. There were no existing inscriptions, literature that mentioned him at all. So people would say he's just a figment of this author's imagination. Well, a couple decades go by, and they unearth a whole bunch of stuff that has since confirmed that this Belshazzar did exist. And there are still, I mentioned last week that there are a couple historical problems still. He's described as a king. In fact, it's his father who is the king, but his father's not reigning at the moment. He's living elsewhere, so Belshazzar is the de facto king. We talked about that last week. So people have said, well, that happened with Belshazzar. Maybe it'll happen with Darius. Maybe it will. But the problem and the difference between those two is that with Belshazzar, there was an absence of evidence. Here, in the case of Darius, it's not that there's an absence of evidence for this historical period. There's actually lots of evidence, and the problem is that there's a different king on the throne, and you know who it is, because he's actually mentioned here in this text and elsewhere in Scripture. It's the king of the Persians. The king of the Persians, the guy who takes over Babylon, is Cyrus. And everyone knows that. And that's just well documented both in Scripture and outside in inscriptions, as well as other Babylonian literature, Persian literature, etc. And so there is a historical problem here. And I don't have a solution for it. Some people have said, well, maybe Darius is another name for Cyrus. Maybe, but the problem is there's no other evidence for that, so that's just sort of a conjecture. It's a possibility. Maybe it is. I just want you to be aware of that, because if you do any sort of digging into Daniel chapter 5 or 6, where Darius is mentioned, this is going to come up. I was searching the internet, and it came up right away. Darius shows that the Bible's wrong. Well, yeah, sorry, but there it is. This can't be resolved, at least at the moment, as far as I know. But I want you to be aware of that, because this isn't just about coming here to get a sort of a boost in our morale before we head off and do our thing. Like, our world and the things that we believe and enjoy and study actually have an impact on the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is actually reading this stuff too. Parts of it anyway. And you need to be aware that sometimes these sort of facts and history don't always reconcile very well. And we go, okay, got to deal with that. Now, to the story itself. Daniel, as we've been working through these chapters, chapters 1 to 6, we've noticed that Daniel has been advancing steadily. He keeps getting promotions, which I think is pretty cool. He starts out being trained as sort of maybe someone who will make it into the nobility. He might be able to work in government. We're going to train him in this form of kind of astrology. So reading stars, reading omens, reading particular signs. Let's cut open a fish and look at its liver, and we'll see that, oh, the shape of this liver indicates that such and such is going to happen. Like, this is the weird but common beliefs that these astrologers, these sages, sometimes they're called Chaldeans, like this is the group that Daniel was a part of, that's the group that he was inducted into when he was taken from Jerusalem and put in Babylon. He was put into the king's service in this particular group of wise men. He was an advisor to the king, but that's how they advised the king, was by reading these signs and omens and so on. It's really strange, but that's the group that Daniel made it into. And interestingly, Daniel has succeeded at that job over and over and over again. He has been faithful with apparently what he has been taught, and he has been faithful to the people that for whom he works, and it's worked out rather well for Daniel. So he's continued to be given promotions. He moves up in the government. Let's remember that this government is the government that took over his people. This government is the corrupt government that destroyed Jerusalem, destroyed God's temple there, captured Daniel and his friends and his family, and the people that they didn't kill, they took to Babylon. Like, this is the corrupt government, and Daniel has a place in it. And he works faithfully on behalf of the people who oversee him. It's a very strange position to be in, but somehow Daniel maintains his integrity through that, and we're going to talk about that later on. So Daniel has moved now in, basically, we would call it politics, and since Daniel's moved up into this sort of government political system. So in our chapter right here, Daniel's second from the top. It's king, and then three overseers, Daniel being one of them, and then 120 satraps below them, which are the, you know, the lower level magistrates overseeing the rest of the empire. Daniel's second from the top here. Daniel's been promoted in government. Christians, so little footnote maybe, maybe Christians can work in government, maybe even for a party, political party, that they might necessarily not be Christian. It's right here. I hate politics, but I like throwing those kinds of things out. So here we go. Daniel, by the fact that he has worked faithfully in these positions, has aroused the jealousy of the people who are his co-workers. And they don't like that they cannot find a way to get at Daniel because his conduct has been exemplary. He has worked these roles, these strange roles, and for these corrupt people with a high degree of integrity, and he has earned the respect of the king. And it's put a target on his back because his other co-workers see him getting in their way of their advancement, because the king wants to promote Daniel and put him above these other two. Remember, king, these three, 120 satraps. He wants to move Daniel up one and still make him under the king, but above these other two who are above the other 120, right? So Daniel's continuing to advance. He's found way too much favor in the eyes of the king for these people. They're incredibly jealous, and he's got a target on his back. Pause. Have you felt like you've done your job to the best of your ability and with a high degree of integrity, and you feel like you got a target on your back? You ever been there? No. It's Daniel. So Daniel's in their way. They want to get rid of him. The problem is they can't find a way to do it based on the way that he's working his business, doing his thing in government. So they say to themselves, the only thing we're going to be able to use is the fact that he has different beliefs than we do, and maybe we can use that against him. So My Sunday school understanding of this now differs slightly from this, the text I've actually been studying this week, which is, this is not about religious persecution. I'd always thought that this was about religious persecution. It's not. Daniel has a target on his back because these people just want to get ahead. And they can't find any way to get ahead by using his current work ethic, so they're going to use his religion against him. But this isn't sort of anti-Jewish, so you can't read it as, well, sometimes people are just against Christians, you know? No, this isn't about religious persecution at all. So, he's just got a target on his back because he's been doing a really good job and people are jealous. So, the co-workers go behind Daniel's back and they say to the king, King, all of us agree, which isn't true because Daniel wasn't in on this, all of us agree that it would be really good for you, which isn't true because the king actually really favors Daniel and has put a lot of trust in him and likes him. We all agree that this would be really good for you to become more of kind of an object of worship, be even more like quasi-divine than you already think you are. We think that that would be a really good idea for you. Maybe it'll create more loyalty among, you sort of unite this broad empire, lots of different people serving lots of different gods. They come from different locales, which means they've had different loyalties. I mean, Daniel was loyal to his God and his king back where they were. But these various peoples who have been conquered have been incorporated into one unit. So they're always looking for ways to, you know, increase loyalty among disparate peoples. Maybe that's part of it. I don't really know. But whatever the reason that they pitch to him, they say, we think that this would be a really good thing because everyone's going to be more loyal to you. You're going to be even more godlike. And we kind of, you got to picture this king. He's kind of like a numpty, like a little bit sort of silly, like naive. And he's just flattered that they would think of him this way. Wow, guys, like that's a really good idea. Like we should do that. That sounds great. Like just go for it. Doesn't even think about it. Beware of people who flatter you. There's a difference between compliment and flattery, right? Compliment, you know, we want to make you feel better about yourself. Flattery, we want something out of it. Beware of people who flatter. It's one thing to say, you look really nice, or you did a good job at that. It's another thing to say, you're so great, like I've always wanted what you have, or, you know, I really wish I could do what you do. Like, you're just, you got to be aware of the difference between compliment and flattery, and beware of flattery. It does not work out well for this king. Daniel's reaction. Daniel hears that this edict has been signed. So there's a new law in town, and he knows about it. And he continues to go about his business as usual. And I like this. From time to time, you'll hear us in our congregational prayers. We'll borrow the Anglican prayer that says, forgive us for the things that we've done and the things that we have left undone. The things that we do are sometimes called the sins of commission. They're the things that we commit. I did that. I shouldn't have done it. I need forgiveness. But we also, there are also those things that we have left undone. The sins of what's called sins of omission, the things that we omit. I should have done that, but I didn't. We're talking here about what would be for Daniel a sin of omission if he stops doing his prayers. Three times a day it says that he prays, but when this edict goes out, he could have had the opportunity, he could have just said, well, pray in my head. I won't go home. Won't kneel. Won't do my usual thing, but I'll still pray in my head. Still loyal to God. But what would that have told God if he had done that? It would have been easier. But would it, like long term, would it have been safer for Daniel actually to tell God, I don't really trust you enough, so I'm just going to stop doing this for a little bit. It's only 30 days, God. It's kind of like a fast. A fast from praying for 30 days, something like that. Would it actually have been safer to tell God he doesn't trust him? Because that's what God would hear. If Daniel stops doing his regular routine, if he stops doing his three times praying to God each day, if he stops doing that because he hears about this new law, he's telling God, I can't trust you. So he goes about business as usual. Now, here's again where the flanograph may have, I don't know if it led me astray or if it's sort of my interpretation looking back on it, but I sort of pictured Daniel in his prayer life, like now that he's heard about this edict, I pictured Daniel, I can't remember if it's on the flanograph or it's just my remembering incorrectly, but I sort of pictured Daniel sort of perched on his windowsill, praying to God in full view of everyone else. That's the picture that I had in my mind, and I don't remember if it was actually up there or what, but it was sort of like a bird perched on the end of his windowsill, looking out for everyone to see. But look at the text. Where is Daniel? It doesn't say. When it mentions the window, it says that Daniel went up to his upper room, which had a window that faced Jerusalem. Does not say that Daniel opened that window. It says that Daniel faced Jerusalem. Does not mean that he was in that window. In fact, windows are, first of all, a source of light. They don't walk into a room and flick a switch, right? The windows are there to let in, first of all, light. Secondly, it doesn't say that he's actually kneeling in the window itself. And you got to picture that this is not like a whole bunch of high rises around. Like, they build low, right? So the fact that he's up high, it's pretty unlikely that anyone is going to be able to see him doing his prayer unless he's right in that window. So is he in that window? I don't know. I don't think so. Remember all those stories in the Gospels where Jesus is at a dinner party and he's been invited, but some other people who weren't invited wander in. We think of our homes as really private and people knock before they enter, and that wasn't the case in the ancient world. In the ancient world, people wander in. They don't have that sort of private public boundary. It's much more fluid. It seems more like these people wandered into his place than that Daniel was actually perched on the edge, sort of provoking in sort of religious anarchy. Yeah, I'm still praying, King. Come catch me and do what you want with me. He is defying the king by praying, but I don't think that, it does not seem, this is my reading of the text, but you got to go back and look at the text yourself. It doesn't seem like he is being intentionally provocative. It seems that he is neither hiding nor trying to provoke anything. Daniel's simply going about the same old business that he's always gone about. That's my reading. You go back and look at it yourself. But I don't think he's being intentionally defiant. But regardless, whether these people wander in or somehow they see him from the street or whatever, he does get caught. But however it is that they catch him, he does get caught, and the king is pretty distraught. Like, the king really likes Daniel. He wanted to promote him even further. And when he finds that this happens, he realizes that his flattery, like his being vulnerable to that flattery, really did work against him. And he's trying to get Daniel out of it, and he discovers that he can't. So they throw Daniel into a pit. This is not a cave, this is a pit. They're lowering Daniel into a pit of lions. They're covering it with a stone, and then it says that they seal it. So there's some sort of wax and probably rope that's been wrapped around this thing so that if the stone were moved, the wax with the seals would break, which would mean that when people came back to check on the tomb, they would recognize that it had been tampered with. So they're making sure and letting everyone know you can't tamper with this. This is the king's seal. Don't mess with it. That's what that seal is about. The king goes home and has a sleepless night. In the morning, the king rushes back to the lion's den, and he calls out and he asks Daniel, "Have you been rescued?" You know, and Daniel's response, look at his response. His response is, "Yeah, I've been rescued because of my integrity, essentially, because I didn't compromise. I haven't done you any harm. I was good before God, and I was good before you." And then the narrator adds a comment and says, "And no harm was found on Daniel because he trusted these gods. We got sort of two themes happening simultaneously, integrity and trust. For those of you who maybe aren't familiar with this word, especially if you're a little bit younger, integrity just means that you are the same person wherever you go. You live your life with the same character in church on Sunday and at school or at work on Monday and at home with my parents, when I'm in front of my grandparents, when I'm parenting my kids, when I'm delivering a sermon, I'm preaching to myself. Daniel is able to trust God partly because he knows that he hasn't done anything against God or the king, and God validates that, recognizes it, and comes through for Daniel. Now, clearly, as the remainder of the story goes, this is a miracle. It's not just that those lions weren't hungry and Daniel got a pass because they'd just been fed, because the 120 satraps plus their two overseers plus all of their families get thrown to the lions. So conservative estimate would be 100,528 bones that get crushed before they hit the floor, according to the literalistic reading of that verse. Read the verse. Verse 23, 24 says that all of those satraps and their families, wives and children, were thrown to the lions, and the lions overpowered them before they even hit the floor and crushed all of their bones. So, you know how much I like numbers? 120,528 bones, all crushed before they hit the floor, if that's the way you always read scripture. So I sort of picture the lions as like little T-Rexes. Maybe that's what happened. What do we do with this story? It's a weird story. What do we do with this story? This is the final story in Daniel before Daniel takes a really strange turn. And if you've read Daniel 7 on, you're like, what world are we in? And we're going to be in that world next week. So I want to take some time looking back on the world we have been in Daniel, because it is more recognizable, this sort of interaction between the people in power and the people who are powerless, the people who are vulnerable. What do you do when you feel like you're in a compromising situation? We talked about this being the land of Shinar that they're in. I want to go back over that. Life in the empire is really hard. Daniel 1:1 talks about how these people, Daniel 1:1 and 2, about how the people in Jerusalem are taken to the land of Shinar. The land of Shinar. There are three things that we talked about back a couple of weeks ago that that phrase, the land of Shinar, means. That's where the Tower of Babel was built. And we talked about how the Tower of Babel is about how God and upward mobility compete. People say, we want to build our own empire and make a name for ourselves our way, and we don't want to have anything to do with God. God and upward mobility compete in the land of Shinar. Yet in Daniel, we see that it's possible to live with integrity and maybe even succeed in a land where God and upward mobility compete. Daniel has managed to navigate that strange dynamic. Even in a place where people are making rules where they don't care about God and where the goals of their lives don't honor God, Daniel finds a way to make a life there with integrity and faithfulness. Daniel, at the very least, suggests that it is possible to live faithfully in a place that is secular or agnostic or just flat out against you and your God. And Daniel is promoted again and again in this oppressive government, and yet he does it with integrity. And I think this passage offers us some hope that it's possible. Maybe it's possible for you, in whatever sort of secular environment you are in, to live a life of integrity and faithfulness to God. In a place where sort of the cards are stacked against you, as they were with Daniel. The land of Shinar was also described as a place where evil is at home, and that comes out of Zechariah chapter 5, where evil is personified as a woman, and this woman is sent to Babylon, to the land of Shinar, it says, where she's going to go and make her home. And have you ever felt like this is a place, contemporary Canadian society, where evil has a legitimate home? Like, right in the very laws themselves sometimes, some of which changed last month. Right? Have you ever felt like evil actually has a legitimate place in parts of our society that the government even blesses? And Daniel, these stories in Daniel have reminded us that it's possible to live as neighbors with evil and still be faithful to God. In fact, Daniel suggests that maybe we should even be neighbors with evil, with all of the discomfort and risk and pain that that brings with it. Daniel suggests that it's possible to live with integrity when the conditions are not for us, even when it puts a target on your back, as it does with Daniel. And it's at that point that we need to trust God more than ever. And Daniel does, and that's what this story is about. Daniel models that for us. Thirdly, Shinar is a place where God seems powerless. The land of Shinar is the place where the temple vessels, God's temple, was conquered, and those vessels were taken to the land of Shinar. In other words, it's a place where their God beat up our God. That's what it looks like. It looks like our God is less powerful than whatever is going on with them. And in Daniel, we find out that although it looked that way, although it looked like God's hands were tied, and although it looks maybe in your life like God is powerless and he is not showing up, Daniel has shown us a number of times that God actually does show up, and God still is very much in control, even when it looks like there's no way that he's going to win this one. He shuts the mouths of the lions. Now, I'd like to pause for a moment and give you an opportunity to say, hey, what about this? Have you thought about this, or could you clarify that? Does anyone have something that they want clarified, or a question that comes to mind as a result of this? Anything you want to interact about?
Ben, can I just...
Yeah, David.
Mm-hmm. How that actually fits with everything else.
How that fits with the rest of the message or the rest of sort of the historical record?
Yeah, just the historical record.
So far as we know, that historical record does not exist. Now, when Cyrus issues his decree that you read about in Ezra, that is reproduced elsewhere, including like not just literature, but also a particular artifact known as the Cyrus Cylinder. But for this particular decree, along with the one that Nebuchadnezzar offers, actually he does two, I believe. End of chapter two, he says, I want to make sure, or end of chapter two, chapter three. Nebuchadnezzar says, as a result of what happened in the fiery furnace, my new decree is that nobody in my kingdom is going to blaspheme this God. And then there's that decree that happens at the end of chapter 4, where he says, all of you people need to go and worship Yahweh because of what happened to me. And now this one as well. We've seen this pattern a number of times, and I think it's a literary device within this book that is showing how God is working with particular kings. And the interesting thing is that we see that happen at the end of chapter 3, chapter 4, and chapter 6, but not chapter 5. And who is chapter 5 about? Belshazzar, the guy who doesn't get that second chance. Right? So... yeah, sorry that there. I wish that sort of it would make it easier, right? Sort of historically, as we wrestle with, well, there's this Darius here that isn't mentioned anywhere else, and what do I do with that? And maybe if we had that decree, that'd be great. But at this moment, we don't. Thanks for raising it. Yeah, Meridell. Yes, thank you for that. At the end, for those of you who couldn't hear Meridel, it says at the end of the verse that the end of the passage that Daniel prospered during the reign of Darius and the reign of Cyrus. And it has to do with the Aramaic, that there's a particular way of translating that could either legitimately in translation be what you said, Darius, he prospered during the reigns of Darius and Cyrus, or it could be Darius that is Cyrus. What's the term is apposition. So you could say Ben, the pastor, right? Pastor is I am a pastor and I am Ben, right? So it could be that way. It could be read that way. Darius, that is Cyrus. Ben, that is the pastor. Or it could be translated as Darius and Cyrus. So it could be translated, if we were translating with the pastor analogy, it could be translated back in Ben and the pastor, meaning someone else. So it's a translational issue. It's an interpretive issue that the people who know Aramaic and make our translations have to come up with. So, and you'll see it footnoted in some Bibles that will actually say Darius, that could be translated Darius, that is Cyrus. But again, the problem is they don't have sort of a wider record, any record that says that Cyrus ever went by the name Darius. Yeah?
At the very bottom, it says, for Darius, that is the reign of Cyrus.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Jack?
I always thought it was a bit strange that Darius couldn't rescind his own law.
Yeah, that is very strange, isn't it? Jack is just pointing out that it seems strange that the king is still powerless because he makes a law that he is now bound by. I have read that is actually that description actually does corroborated by other external evidence that says that they did have laws that even kings couldn't repeal once they had made. It's a very strange thing, and part of the reason that I think it gets highlighted a number of times in the text is not just to show that this was the case, but that even though this king was powerless, God wasn't powerless to do something about it. So I think, once again, it has that sort of literary function as well. So, yeah, thanks for highlighting it. Thanks, great interactions, interesting observations. If you're sitting here being like, man, like I think that, I love the fact that Daniel trusted God. I think that's so admirable, but if you're sitting here going, I like that, I think it's so admirable, but I could never do that, that's not me. I know it can feel discouraging. Like, we hold these people up in such high esteem. We're like, I am never going to get there. I do not see the steps to me ever becoming like this Daniel guy. You can start to feel guilty about that. You wonder, where do I go from here? How do I actually do anything with this if I could never live up to it? Can I remind you that Daniel, at this point, has lived in exile for more of his life than he's lived anywhere else? Daniel's an old dude. And it doesn't mean that old people are suddenly able to trust more than you can. But Daniel has had the experience over decades and decades of being in a position where he didn't have a choice. He had to trust God. And we live really, really comfortable lives. And basically, I trust my bank account more than I trust God, because I'm going to be okay because there's some money there. So we have to ask ourselves, what do we need to do to put ourselves in a position where maybe we actually need to grow in our trust? Like, maybe I actually need to take a few more risks. Because at some point in my life, right now, but at some point in your life, you're going to need to really trust God. You'd be like, man, I wish I had actually learned to trust him in smaller things. Well, what are the smaller things that you could put in place now to begin building that trust? How do you build trust? You got to be in a position to need to trust someone. I'm going to wrap it up with just one suggestion. The way to start building trust, I would suggest one practical thing that every one of you can do is start fasting. Fasting is one of the ways where we learn to depend on God instead of the caffeine that's going to keep me going for the rest of the day, or that next meal, or that sugar high at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, or that sugar low, and I need something to bring me up. Fasting is about abstaining from something, giving it up for a period of time so that I learn to trust God. I learn to depend on him. What did Daniel start doing when he got to Babylon? He started fasting. And we had a message on this. It was the second message of this series. Rob preached it. Daniel starts fasting. Daniel starts early on learning to trust God with smaller things. So that by the time that we get to this particular story, he's been doing this a long time, and he's learned in much smaller ways that he has to trust God. Because he lives in a really risky place. And maybe you go to work in a really risky place. And Daniel has put disciplines in place to become the person that he needs to be when the crisis comes. Maybe we could heed that warning. I'll give you a moment for reflection, and then we're going to move to a time of communion. Communion is related to trust. When Jesus offers this meal to the first people who receive it, it is very much with an attitude that I am trusting that God is going to bring me through this. Jesus himself. Jesus is about to go to the cross, and he knows that he is about to hit the crisis like he's never hit a crisis before. And he offers an act of trust. He says that you are going to continue doing this in remembrance of me until we do this again when the kingdom is fulfilled. Jesus trusts that this death is not going to be the end of it. He entrusts himself to the Father. And so we, as we participate in this, we are remembering that act of incredible trust where Jesus entrusts his full life and destiny to the Father himself. And the Father vindicates him. So let's take a moment and offer ourselves to God.